I want to take up in June the 6th, 1923, in volume 15. We began a little bit of it last week, but I want to do the whole thing. And here we're talking about our desires. The heading says, the sign that the soul is all for God is that she has a taste for nothing but him. That means she desires nothing but him. So put the word desire there. And before we even start, I want to give you Psalm 10:3, Psalm 21:2. You probably have this from last week. Yeah. I have to do it for the recording, though. Psalm 38, verse 9, Psalm 40, verses 6 to 8. So Louisa said, I was concerned about the reason why my Jesus wasn't coming. And I said to myself, who knows what evil there is in my interior? Now, she's kept that up for 15 volumes, regardless of the fact of what Jesus has told her. And so that he hides himself so as not to be displeased. Now, this hiding of himself, I want to give you a new reference there. And that's Luke 17:21. The kingdom of God is within you. Where would you look for him? He is within. So he, moving in my interior, told me, my daughter, the sign that there's nothing evil and that the interior of the soul is completely, notice completely, filled with God, is that nothing is left for her which is not all mine. Okay. Now, what he's doing is he's giving us a bit of discernment to find out if we have, in fact, filled ourselves completely with God. And that is, there would be nothing left to her except what is his. And that in everything that may happen inside and outside of her, she no longer desires anything. Her desire is only for the Lord and from him. Now, I've changed that into desire for you because it makes sense, doesn't it? And not only with profane and indifferent things, but also with holy things, pious people, I love that, services, music and everything, because you can go to Mass or any religious service for a completely selfish thing that you want to save your own soul. And you mightn't be going to give any glory to God. And you mightn't be going to praise and worship him and to love your neighbour as yourself. So he said, everything is cold and indifferent to her, all this stuff that impresses everybody else, and like something that does not belong to her. And the reason is natural. If the soul is completely filled with the Lord, she's also filled with his desires. Now, if you get filled with his desires, you will be very interested in his church and you will be very interested in his people and you will be very interested in spreading his word and his life so that the people are saved. Because 1 Timothy, I think it's 3, I'm not sure. God wants everyone to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. So he says, my desire is hers and other desires find no place in which to put themselves. I gave you the Song of Songs, my beloved is mine and I am his. His desire is for me and mine is for him. That's Song of Songs 7:10. You have that one, haven't you? Therefore, as beautiful as they may be, they hold no attraction for this soul. Rather, they are as though dead for her. So let's put it this way. Other people will spend hours watching the television, entertaining themselves with all kinds of junk. I couldn't get myself to turn it on. Why? It's a different planet. It's a different world. It's not where you're living. It's not the level that you're living at. You're not going to find an eagle scratching the ground looking for something on the ground, are you? No, they're the seagulls and they make a fierce amount of noise. Whereas the eagle takes to the skies, you know, and the Lord has called us to be eagles spiritually. So you have to take to the skies. So I gave you references for that, didn't I? Now let's come to the next paragraph. On the other hand, this is very Jewish, on the one hand and on the other hand, you know. On the other hand, the soul who is not completely mine is empty. Now notice there's only two things given to you here. You're either full or you're empty. Now notice the Lord doesn't accept the fact that I could be half full. Because if I'm half full, the other half has junk that he's not interested in. So he's as far as he's concerned, you're either full or empty of him. And as things surround her, she feels as many desires within herself if those are things which she likes. If, on the other hand, they are things she doesn't like, she feels disgust for them. And so she's in a continuous alternation of desire and disgust. That's typical of the way people live, isn't it? And since any desire which doesn't come from me is not lasting, they're really hot about something today and cold about it tomorrow, many times desires turn into disgusts. And this is why many variations in character are noticed. At one stage, the person is really interested in serving the neighbour, and then the next thing, they're not even interested in the neighbour's name. So the variations in character. At one stage, they're too sad or they're too cheerful. In other words, they're down too much or they're up too much. They're all irascible. You can't touch them. They're like porcupines. And another time, they're all affable. They're all friendly. So there's too much variation there. And this is volume 15. And you have to remember all the things that have been told to you up to now. And that is that the soul who is in God must be stable. They must continue in their love and service of God to himself and to their neighbours with no variation. That there's actually it's continuous praise and glory to God and continuous love and service for him as well. So it is the void of me. Now we're talking about the ones who are not desiring the Lord. It's the void of me that she has in her soul and gives her so many variations in character. It's nothing similar to mine, for I'm always the same and I never change. You see the immutability of God. And he's been telling us for many volumes that we have to become like him. And therefore the soul becomes very, very stable. So he's going to give us discernment now in the next paragraph. And it's all about these desires. So kind of who are you and is shown in what you desire. So now, do you have any desire for what exists down here that's on earth? What do you fear? That there be some evil in you and that because of it displeased I hide myself? Wherever I am, Jesus said, there cannot be evil. Now, I've given you references for that ad nauseam. But first of all, I want to give you the first letter of St. John, chapter 3, verses 2 to 6, that anybody who's truly in God does not sin. Okay. So I want to give you 1 John 2, verse 6, verse 17, and verses 24 to 29. I want to give you my usual Hebrews 12, 14. Nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. Isaiah 35, verse 8. On the road that the redeemed are on, those who are unclean cannot join it. There's lots of others as well. So, wherever I am, there cannot be evils. Now, from volume one, the Lord has been telling us that the one thing he hates is sin. Sin is totally intolerable to him. And the reason why we get chastisements is that sin rises up from the earth and sent right back to us in chastisement. Okay, so wherever I am, there can be no sin. And this is the reason why when we are trying to grow in closeness to God, that there will be continuous purification. It doesn't stop. And we have seen the level of spirituality that Louisa is at. And she's still being purified. Okay, it doesn't stop as long as you're breathing on this earth. He has even used the lovely expression that something made of gold needs to be dusted. So Louisa said, my love, I don't feel like getting a desire for anything, as good as it might be. Now, Louisa at this point still doesn't realise that all these teachings are for generations coming after her. So she reacts only from her own personal position. How can I get a taste for other things if the pain of your privation absorbs me, embitters me down to the marrow of my bones and makes me forget about everything? And the only thing which is present to me and driven into my heart is the nail that I am without you. So she's saying, you've really got me on this privation thing. I couldn't possibly think of anything else. Now, but most other people are not at that level. And along with your relationship with God, you might want other things as well. And Jesus said, the fact that you only think of me, this tells you that you are mine and that you are filled with me, because every desire has this power. It is my desire. If it is my desire, it transforms the creature into me. That's 2 Corinthians 3:18. Okay. That you are transformed into the image that you reflect in contemplation. And also John 8:32, it's the truth that sets you free. And Jesus keeps on making sure that Louisa sees the truth. Truth is reality as it really is. And so Jesus keeps on keeping Louisa at this very sharp edge of truth. So if it is a natural taste, he said, it sweeps you into human things. The her is the soul. if it is a desire for passions, it casts her into the current of evil. It may even seem a desire is something trivial, but it is not so. Watch this. The desire is the first act of either good or evil. That's a very, very important statement that's being made there. And he's going to illustrate this here. But I remember years ago giving a retreat to a community of enclosed sisters. And there was one particular one who was really willing to share with me. And I said to her, look, can I take a risk and ask you a question? And I promise I'll never tell anybody who you are or anything else. And she said, no, it's okay. I said, when you go to confession, now I'm talking about a nun who's been in an enclosed monastery under solemn vows for years. I couldn't even imagine what she would tell in confession. Okay. I said, when you go to confession, what do you confess? Now, anybody could say, sorry, off limits. She didn't. She never even hesitated. She said, I confess the first movements. I said, don't tell me anything else. I know everything you're trying to tell me. I said, that's what I wanted. What she's saying is that, you know, you go from the sin and all its fruits up here, and then you go down to the roots, and you go down and down, and then you get to the finest roots, where there's no possibility of any more sin. That's where she was at. So that if there was any temptation to anger or anything else, she was picking it up so completely at the roots, there would never be an expression of it. It's absolutely incredible. And that's what Jesus is saying here. The desire is the first act in either good or evil. And he wants to bring us to a level of holiness whereby you actually deal with the first movements. Is that okay? Now watch how he's going to illustrate this in the case of Adam. And so the next paragraph is he's actually telling us how Adam sinned. Why did Adam sin, he said. One, he removed his gaze from the divine attraction. And he turned it to something else. It actually doesn't matter what the something else was. And as Eve presented the fruit to have him eat it, he looked at the fruit. So once he starts looking at it, the desire is awake. And his sight took pleasure in looking at it. His hearing took delight in hearing the words of Eve, that if he ate the fruit, he would become like God. And his palate took pleasure in eating it. So desire was the first act of his ruin. Now, can I give you that in very simple language for ladies? I don't know for the gentlemen, but for the ladies. You're going along the street and you're just going about your business. You pass by this wonderful shop and you see this magnificent blouse, coat or skirt or whatever it is that you like. You don't need it at all. But when you see it, you can think of 10 reasons why you have to buy that. Mm-hmm. And it's your eyes have created the desire. Does that make sense to you? Mm-hmm. That's what he's talking about. Your eyes are now on an object, which has nothing to do with God. You know you don't need the darn thing, but you're going to go in and buy it anyway. Because you say, oh, I'm sure one of my nieces could get married, you know. Or we could have to go on holidays, or we might have to visit the relatives or whatever. You think of all kinds of reasons. And all you're trying to do is justify the fact that you're giving in to your desire. And so I recommend a particular exercise to you. It actually works, a treat. And that is, go to a shopping centre. Well, you probably have to go on business anyway. And go to one of these clothes shops and stand outside. I've done it. It works. Thanks be to God, I need nothing. And walk on. It works a treat. You've no idea how it liberates you. But you must try it. Because otherwise you can leave this stuff in theory. You see, Jesus is explaining something very simple. Adam took his eyes off that and put them onto something else. And therefore began desiring it. Isn't that it? All you've got to do is go around into one of these shops. And there's lots of stuff there. They're all nice. Well, some of it's nice anyway. But you don't need the half of it. But you'll come out with a few bags. Am I wrong or am I right?
You're right.
I've been asked by a few people, had I gone to a particular store to see it? And I said, no, thanks. I don't need any more temptations. I said, they can keep their store. They can keep everything that's in it. They can keep their reputation. They can keep everything. And I'll try and keep me. So it's a wonderful thing to just say, thanks be to God, I don't need. I actually make the sign of the cross. And I don't care if anybody sees me. And of course, the place is milling with people and they probably think your wand's off her head. I don't mind because it's actually liberating me. Do you see what I'm saying? We need to actually action this stuff. Because then you'll realise that Jesus is saying, if you catch something in the bud, you're okay. You're going to save yourself a lot of trouble and probably a lot of money as well. So here's poor Adam. He took his eyes off the ball. Isn't that what we say?
Mm-hmm.
Right. On the other hand, if he had felt displeasure in looking at it, if he had felt tedium and bother in hearing the words of Eve, if he had felt disgust in eating it, Adam wouldn't have sinned. All of those things would have blocked him. Okay. On the contrary, he would have done the first heroic act of his life. Now, sometimes a heroic act for you may not be a heroic act for somebody else. But if that dress in the window is something you want badly and you say, no, thank you, Lord, it looks really nice and I'm going to leave it where it is in the window and I'm going to walk away free just because I love you. That can be heroic. I'm only giving it something completely obvious. There's lots of other things as well. But if I don't make this practical, you're not going to really hear the challenge that's in it, okay? So if Adam had resisted, he would have made the first heroic act of his life. Now, why is this the only heroic one? Because there's sacrifice in it. There's self-denial in it, okay? And we have been told from volume one that we must have the sacrifice, we must have the self-denial, we must put the self aside if we want God to rule, okay? So he would have done the first heroic act of his life by resisting and correcting Eve. Why does the correcting Eve come in? Because he is the head. And one of the reasons why women are running amok today, excuse my language, I'd be hung in the first three if anybody outside the house heard me, is that men have become passive. And they're not taking their leadership roles. Look at all that's happening in Ireland and the bishops are as silent as Adam. So he would have corrected Eve for having done that, and he would have remained with the everlasting crown of faithfulness towards the one to whom he owed so much and who had all the rights of his subjection. Isn't that something? Oh, how careful one must be with the different desires that arise in the soul. If they are purely divine desires, you must give them life. But if they're purely human ones or of the passions, you must give them death. Death means mortification and self-denial. OK, I want to give you Matthew 5:27-30. Matthew 5:27-30. Where Jesus gives all the instruction, you know, it was said of old about, he gives five different examples. He says, but I say to you, okay. Otherwise, he said, you have the difficulty that you could fall into the current of evil. Okay. Do you remember the story of Peter at the time of the arrest of Jesus? It was pure curiosity that made him want to follow Jesus at a distance. And how did he fall? Yeah. Oh, boys. He ended up cursing and swearing he never knew the man. Because he shouldn't have taken that. He shouldn't have followed that desire. He should have denied himself that, and he should have waited until grace could help him. Okay. So June 10th, 1923, the humanity of Jesus is our door to the divine will. Everything is through him, with him, and in him, as the church has been teaching us since the beginning. I was lamenting to my sweet Jesus about his privations, Louisa said, and I thought to myself, who knows what his reason is for not coming. You won't have to put up with that because she'll keep it up. But she will stop at a certain point. And the transformed Louisa in beyond volume 20 is really admirable. It's wonderful. Who knows the reason why he's not coming? And if it's true, as sometimes he made me understand, that he doesn't come because of the chastisements. He told her that's the case every time. Since given the state of victim in which he keeps me, if he comes, having to communicate pains to me because of the office that I occupy, he feels his arms being broken. That's the power of justice. And since justice wants to punish, as the humanity forces it to do so with its sins, this is why he doesn't come. So if this is the case, then he should remove me from the state of victim. As long as he comes, I care little about anything else. What I care about is that Jesus is my life and my all. Galatians 2:20. I no longer live, Christ lives in me. Psalm 23 verse 1. The Lord is my shepherd. He takes care of everything. Now, by volume, we're coming to the end of volume 15, and Louisa has not yet understood that one of the biggest powers of intercession that she has is the privations, because they're the things that are causing her the most pain. And so the Lord is shifting her from her victim soul status to a completely spiritual mission in opening the kingdom of the divine will on earth. It's going to take her a while to understand it, but when she gets it, she's going to be very happy in herself. Now, while I was thinking of this and other things, Louisa said, my sweet Jesus, moving in my interior and surrounding my neck with his arm, told me, my daughter, what are you saying? Deposing you from your office. You don't know what it means to lose dominion and to lose the right to command. Now, if you have remembered any of the dialogues between Louisa and Jesus when she is even being impertinent with him to try and get him to stop the chastisement, she is using her office and with the power of command to get something out of the Lord. He says, you don't realise what losing this is, and to no longer to be able to dispose of anything. In fact, when someone is in office, he can always dispose. If he is a judge, he can judge. He has the right to issue a condemnation and also to absolve. It may be that for days or weeks he doesn't exercise the office because the occasions are lacking. But in spite of this, he receives his pay. He maintains his rights. And as guilty or righteous people present themselves to him, he is at his post as judge. And he can defend or condemn according to needs. But if he is deposed, he loses all rights and is reduced to inability. Now, this is the first time that Jesus has told Louisa just what the consequences would be, because she often says to him, well, sure, take me to heaven, you know, if you're going to do this and that and the other. And she doesn't realise the consequences of what she's saying. This time he tells her. if he's deposed, he's reduced to inability. And so with all the other offices. Therefore, content yourself with being without me sometimes rather than wanting to be deposed from your office. Otherwise, you will also lose the right of having the deserved scourges held back in part. She only has that right as a victim soul. When you and I pray and we're not victim souls, we don't get that result. We don't have that office. Okay? And if it seems to you that because of the lack of pains for a few days that you do nothing, remain in office. To remain in office is always something. And what you don't do on one day, as I come and find you in office, you'll do on another day. So you remember that wonderful poem by Milton on his blindness?
Paradise Lost?
I don't know whether it is Paradise Lost or not. It's just a poem on his blindness. And he says, this one talent that I have is taken from me. Okay. And then he goes on and he says, God does not need either man's work or his own gifts. He has thousands at his bidding, speed and post o'er land and ocean without rest. They also serve who only stand and wait. That was an incredible insight on his part. And that's what Jesus is saying here. If you did nothing, the very fact that you have this office and that it is recognised by God means that you also serve when you only stand and wait. And for that, I want to give you Isaiah 40:31. They that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like the eagle. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. That's just the waiting upon the Lord. I want to give you Isaiah 49:23. And Lamentations 3:25. So in the next paragraph, Jesus is going to tell us that the door to the divine will is his sacred heart. It's his whole humanity. So that's John 10:7. I'm the gate. Okay. But this isn't all. It's the least part, Jesus said. The most essential is that in order to live in my will, the door through which to enter, the first link of connection is my humanity. Therefore, you can't live in the divine will without a personal relationship with God, to put it mildly. Okay. This isn't just a devotion in which you say prayers. My humanity was indeed the first and true victim, which, because of the office given to me by my celestial Father, lived as sacrificed and completely crucified in the divine will. Will you put NB beside that? He's saying to Louisa, you must live continuously sacrificed to the divine will. And that's what the call that's been given to us is, that you will be disposed to sacrifice yourself at every single moment. Not my will, but thine be done. No matter what happens, not my will, but thine be done. Not my will, but thine be done. And it's easy to say that until somebody crosses you. You know. And when you get crossed more and more and more and more, it can be difficult and you can be wanting time out. But it's, you have to remain continuously sacrificed, okay, to him. That's a very important point. Okay. And by virtue of the power of my divine volition, he said, it was able to multiply my life for everybody and in each soul. That is past, present and future. And just as the power of one single fiat, I multiplied so many created things. That is, the whole of creation was the I want of God in Genesis chapter 1. If you want to put Genesis 1 there. Let there be light, and there was light. Giving to each creature the right to make them her own. In the same way, the power of my will multiplied one single life so that each one might have me for himself alone. He is all for me as if nobody else existed. He's going to explain that in the next paragraph. So that each one might have me for himself alone as help, as defence, as refuge, whatever he needs. And now, this was explained in the early volumes. I think it's down in volume 2. that some people at different times in their lives, they need him as saviour, they need him as healer, they need him as teacher, they need him as friend, they need him as lover, they need him as whatever. And he said, I'm that for them at that moment, whatever it is they need. And here it's defence and refuge and everything. So this is all the greatness, the good, that all, the all, the infinite distance between the living in my will and the living of a different way. Now, you need to colour that if you have a colour. There's an infinite difference between ordinary spirituality and living on this divine level. It's the distance between the human will and the divine, which is infinite, no matter how good or holy it is. The multiplication of one act into as many acts as one wants, enough for as many souls as one wants to have the use of them. So it's very good to just remind yourself and say to the Lord, I want to multiply these acts to infinity. It covers everybody for all time. Okay. So the next paragraph, he underlines, we can only live in the divine will at this level through him, with him and in him. Do you remember John 15:5? Without me, you can do nothing. Okay. And Philippians 4:13, I can do all things in Christ who gives me the strength. So this is a very important passage. Now, if I deposed you from office, Jesus said to Louisa, not only would you not occupy my office on earth, since you would not be in my humanity, which even though it did much, impetrating so much good for man, yet did not take the rights, the honour and the decorum away from my justice when it would require to punish man justly. So what he's saying there, I've said to you already, and that is that there's an infinite balance between all the attributes of God. The justice of God must express itself at the right time. The love of God express itself at the right time. The mercy of God represents itself at the right time. But we're inclined to think that mercy means being let off the hook, as if God has some kind of a dump, you know, and he can dump things that he doesn't want. There are no dumps in God, and there's no dumps in God's kingdom. Everything has to be dealt with. Everything has got to be redone, recycled, remade. There's no dumps. And so there are times when justice absolutely has to be done. Okay. But justice is also loving. And justice is also merciful, because all the attributes of God are infinite. They're all equal. And there's this incredible balance between one and the other. And the intercession that Louisa does as a victim soul is to try and pull mercy when she thinks that the justice is too strong. And she does get some, you know, it's really amazing. So he has to allow the justice as well as the love. Rather, he said, I would resign myself, but in lacking the link of connection, you would not be able to live in my will. OK, that's like saying, if this house isn't wired for electricity, you can turn on the switch anytime you like. You're not going to get electricity because I'm not connected. OK. But in lacking the link of connection, you would not be able to live in my will. You would lose dominion. Your acts would become simple intentions. In other words, you'd like to do something, but it's not real. And when you would say, my Jesus, in your will, I love you, I bless you, I thank you for all, I feel sorrow for each offence, etc. Your acts would not hover over each human act to become the act of each human act, the love of each love that creatures should give to me. You would not follow all my acts which are present in my will. You would remain behind. They would just be pious intentions at the most, which can do some good, but they're not acts for everyone, for all souls, past, present and future, which may give life and contain the power of our creative will. That really, really, really needs to be looked at over and over again. Okay. Because what I notice in myself is that you can get the gist of it, but the implications of it is another matter altogether. And so you have to go into it quite deeply. So, and yet how many times Jesus said, you tell me, since you have called me into your will, do not leave me behind. O Jesus, let it be that together with you, I may follow the acts of creation to requite you for the love of all created things, as well as those of redemption and of sanctification. She's talking about the rounds, okay? So that wherever your acts and your love are present, they might have a requital of mine. That's us putting our love you on absolutely everything. And now you want to leave me behind, he said. He wants me to leave you behind, so you won't be able to do any of that. So Louisa said, I remained confused and didn't know what to answer. It's really wonderful when he gets her to the point of not being able to talk, because she's an Italian. My good Jesus disposes as he pleases, she said, and let everything be for his glory. Okay. So June the 15th, 1923, the subject is love, because the summary of the 36 volumes is divine will and love. God is love. Divine will is the essence of God. So if there's no love in us, there's certainly not divine will. And if we think there's divine will in us and we're not loving, then we've a complete contradiction. So Louisa says, continue in my usual state. I was praying that my beloved Jesus would deign to come to visit this poor soul. And he, all goodness, did come. And he made himself seen as he kept touching me up. I love that. That's Philippians 1:6. He completes the work that he began in you. And this is him dusting the gold or the Waterford glass. Do you know what I mean? He kept touching me up all over with his hand. And in touching me, he would leave a light. Why? Because God is light. And this whole spirituality of the divine will is to transform us into light. In other words, to spiritualize us. You remember on Mount Tabor, Jesus was transformed into light. And so they suddenly saw him in his divinity. He would leave a light as a mark at that point where he had touched me. After this, he disappeared. And my first confessor came. Now, you need to know at this particular point that two of her confessors have already died. Okay. This is 1923, and she's had confessors since before 1900, for a couple of years before that. So the first confessor came, who is now deceased. Now, he can only come if she's out in an out-of-the-body experience and she'll meet him on a spiritual level. Is that okay? And he told me, I too want to touch you, he said, at those points where the Lord touched you. Almost not wanting, and as though lacking the strength to oppose, I let him do it, she said. But as he was doing it, that light which Jesus had left in touching me was communicated to him. You see, he's now on the other side, and he knows that if the Lord has touched you, I can have a bit of this as well. Okay. And he remained as though invested with so much light for as many touches as he gave me, always at the same points where Jesus had touched me. I remained surprised, and the confessor told me, the Lord has sent me. You see, a soul on the other side cannot come unless the Lord has permitted it. The Lord has sent me to give me the recompense of the merit I acquired when I could come to you to do you charity. Oh, I hate that expression. And would act upon you. Now, this has turned into the light of eternal glory. Now, throughout these writings, Jesus has said, and he's also said it very clearly in Maria Valtorta's writings, that everything you do, I mean everything, every thought, every word, every action, every desire is all noted in the Book of Life. Everything. We need to remember that a little bit more often, especially when the tongue wants to get loose, that everything's written in the Book of Life. And here the priest is saying that because I came and I served you, he's now allowing me, even that I'm on the other side, to receive something. So I have a question for you, and you can answer it even though I'm on this. Is he in heaven?
No, he's in a high level of purgatory.
Yeah, he can't be in heaven if he's still looking for something. Yeah. So, but he's probably in a very high place in purgatory. And it's obvious from the way he's communicating that it's not actually a painful place. Okay. And so the levels of purgatory that the saints have told us about is actually quite important. But he's still looking for something. So I want to give you Romans 8:18. And you can have the verses after that as well. Psalm 3:3. And Psalm 8:5. So now the second confessor who has died obviously has seen the first one get something, and he arrives and he wants something as well. Poor Louisa. She's the one who wants to go to heaven, and they're coming back to get something from her. So afterwards, the second confessor came, who was also deceased, and he told me, "Tell me what Jesus said to you. I want to hear it. Now tell me, is he in heaven?" No. If he still has a need, he's not in heaven, but they would be in this very high place in purgatory. I want to hear it so that the light of the divine truths may unite to the many lights of the truths which the Lord spoke to you, with which in hearing them from you, when I was alive, I remained as though impregnated. Now, the Lord has sent me to confirm for me the recompense of the merit I acquired by wanting to hear these truths. Isn't that interesting? Now, the first priest said that the Lord was blessing him for the service that he had given to Louisa, and the second one because he wanted so badly to hear the teachings. I find that interesting. So notice that the Book of Life knew exactly the difference between the two of them. If you knew what it means to hear the divine truths, what charm of light they contain, such that the sun would remain eclipsed, and the good that they bring to the one who speaks them and to the one who listens to them. Notice that there's two blessings going on at this moment, the one who speaks them and the one who listens. Now, hopefully the one who's speaking them is listening as well. Okay. He said, you would compete, you in speaking them. And the one who feels the duty to do so, listening to them. Therefore, hurry and tell me, he said, what did the Lord say to you? And Louisa remembered that the Lord had told her what charity means. And she said it to him. My words turned into light because he's on the other side, okay, and invested him, and all content he disappeared. So I want to give you, there's really only one psalm you need for that, in Psalm 119. It's all about the word of God. The most wonderful psalm is the longest psalm in the book. But I want to give you verse 2. Verse 25, verses 33 to 40, 49 to 50, 89, 105, etc. Your words are a lamp for my step and a light for my path. You remember? Mm-hmm. Okay. And this is what he's telling her, that the word of God is a light that he receives directly into himself. Now, Louisa told the priest the message about love, but she didn't tell us. So the Lord comes, I think it's our present confessor, insists on her telling us what she told the priest. And that's in the next long paragraph. What is charity or agape love, divine love? And she's going to be talking about love transforming everything into fire. Now, when you do the hours of the Passion, you'll hear her saying that Jesus' blood was on fire. You know, his heart was on fire. The extraordinary thing, I've said this to you before, that the Bible uses images for different things, and only the context will tell you what the meaning of the thing is. Like, for example, God is fire. Our God is a consuming fire. They said that from Mount Sinai. And you find it in Hebrews 10:29. Fire is the image of hell. It's the exact opposite of God. Fire is also used in the Bible as an image of war, of tribulation, trials, difficulties, struggles, everything. And it's only the context will tell you what fire. But when you come to the New Testament, fire is the image of the Holy Spirit. He came down in tongues of fire. Do you remember? When love reaches a certain point of consummation, it's transformed into fire. Now, a number of the saints have said that they experienced actual fire in their hearts, and one of them was Thérèse of Lisieux. Okay. So now I will say what Jesus had told me about charity. So you're talking about divine love, not just human love. My daughter, with its power, true charity can convert all things into love. Okay. Now, the example that Thérèse gives is very simple. She said you can pick a pin off the floor out of pure love. That's the charity we're talking about here. And she said it's worth all the projects on the planet. You can have somebody else doing some big, huge project and everybody's totally impressed, but if there's no love in it, God has no interest in it. Okay. So, my daughter, with its power, true charity can convert all things into love. Look at fire, he said. All varieties of wood and any other thing, it converts all of them into fire. And if it did not have the power to convert everything into fire, it would not be given the name of true fire. It is the same for the soul. If she does not convert all things into love, both supernatural and natural things, joys and bitterness, everything that surrounds her, she cannot be said to possess true charity. Okay, we have to be practical about this. That means that you're going through a difficult time right now. And you can either use it to complain and to get depressed about it and to give out about it and blah, blah, blah. 0 out of 100. No love. Or you can look at the thing, look at it as an opportunity for you to step up to the mark and start learning to love in a completely new way. And the love involves forgiveness, patience, kindness, goodness, blah, blah, blah. And therefore you're growing, God is glorified, and there's no crisis. Are you getting it? So every crisis is actually transformed into something that's life-giving. So it's the same for the soul. If she does not convert all things into love, both supernatural and natural things, joys and bitterness, everything that surrounds her, she cannot be said to possess true charity. Now, as he was saying this, Jesus let many flames come out of his most sacred heart. And these flames filled both heaven and earth, and then uniting together formed one single flame. There was only one motivation that Jesus had, and it was love. And she brings this, Louisa brings this out very clearly in the Hours of the Passion, that the biggest passion for Jesus was love. Do you remember? The second one was the passion for sin, and the third one was what she calls the passion of the Jews. And then Jesus added, continuous flames of love come from my heart. Now, that's been illustrated perfectly with Margaret Alacoque, isn't it? And to some, they bring love. To some, they bring pain. To some, they bring light. To others, they bring strength, etc. In other words, the fire that comes from his heart and reaches you transforms into what you need. Okay. Sorry, but if you need the pain in order to get your act together, then it's transformed into pain for you. We've all had that one, haven't we? Okay. Sometimes it's transformed into light for you. That means you receive understanding or enlightenment. Okay. That's when you're reading and studying the scriptures or you're in prayer or whatever. To others, it gives them strength. So they're going through a very difficult time, and they find this interior infusion of strength. Now, that's called usually fortitude, that strength, the strength for the soul. And because they come from the center of the furnace of my love, Jesus says, even though they do different things, since the purpose is the same, that is to send love to the creature, then all the flames uniting together form one thing. No matter what the expression is, it's love. Now, for that, I have to give you what I usually give you. Psalm 145, verse 17. God only ever acts out of love. He doesn't have any other thing. So it has to be the same for you. Instead of the creature, just put you. Okay. You and me. Even if the soul does different things, the purpose must be love. Now, we've been told this since volume one, that the only acceptable motivation if you're trying to live the divine will, spirituality, is love. No other motivation is acceptable. So saving your own soul is not it. That's a much lower level of religion. Okay. So no matter what it is, the purpose must be love. So even if I'm in the difficult thing where I've got to overcome myself and love has to be expressed in forgiveness, I will forgive the person for love of Jesus. And that makes it an awful lot easier. Because if you're trying to forgive the person for something they have in themselves, the problem is that we'll say they don't deserve it. That's exactly what mercy is, love given to someone who doesn't deserve it. And if you want to give love to someone who doesn't deserve it, I think the first thing you should do is get a mirror and look straight at the person in the mirror and say, yeah, you like mercy, try and give it. You like God and everybody else understanding you and accepting you and being merciful and kind to you and giving you space and, as we say in Ireland, giving you slack. Try giving that to somebody else. The very best person to preach to is a mirror. Recommend it highly. And it's amazing if the person actually listens to you. And if the person in the mirror actually listens to you, believe me, you'll never criticise anybody else for not doing it. I don't know if you've ever said to yourself, I told you that this morning and you've already forgotten. Okay? When we have the trials and the difficulties and we have to overcome ourselves to be loving and all the rest of it, go to the person in the mirror. And you'll be surprised, you might see somebody else smiling behind you as well, saying, oh, she's getting the act together. Okay. So no matter what it is, the purpose must be love, so as to be able to make of her actions as many little flames which, uniting together, will form the great flame that will burn everything and will transform her completely into me. Now, God is love, and it means the transformation is into love. Okay. So here's another major discernment for how we're doing in the spirituality of the divine will. If gradually our lives are turning more and more towards love, then we're in the right direction. If the self still has quite a throne, get worried. So I want to give you the usual references there. Matthew 22, verses 34 to 40. Jesus says, the love of God and neighbour, the whole scripture hinges on it. Matthew 22, verses 34 to 40. John 13, verses 34 to 35, this is the command I give you, to love one another in the same way as I love you. Okay. And that's a very important one, because Jesus is not asking us to love one another as human beings do it when they feel like it. He says, I'm commanding you to love one another as I love you, which is a different thing altogether. And then Ephesians 3, verses 16 to 21, you must be grounded in love, grow in love, reach the fullness of love, and therefore the fullness of Christ. Now, there's a lot in that, isn't there? So June the 18th, 1923, we're still on love. And this is a long one. And I have a VIP several times on this one. It's huge. Louisa said, I was feeling all absorbed in the holy will of God, and blessed Jesus made present to me, as though in act, all the acts of his life on earth. You see, all his acts were on the level of divine will, so they're permanent. They're absolutely there. They're available to us as if they were happening right now. And since I had received him sacramentally in my poor heart, he made me see, as though in act in his most holy will, the moment in which my sweet Jesus, in instituting the most holy Eucharist, communicated himself. Okay, it's very important. Now, I don't know any other saint who has ever spoken of this. Okay. But that just might be ignorance on my part. It's just I haven't come across it. How many wonders, how many prodigies, how many excesses of love in this act of communicating himself, she said. My mind wandered amid so many divine prodigies, and my beloved Jesus said, beloved daughter of my supreme will contains everything. That's why we will know that we're actually moving deeper and deeper into the divine will when other desires begin to disappear. My will contains everything. It preserves all the divine works as though in act. Now, you'll get this explained over and over and over again as we go on in the volumes, that God not only created the universe, but he keeps it in existence for every second. Okay? He preserves what he creates. He preserves us as well. If he removed himself from us, we would simply fall in a heap on the floor. We would vaporize. We would disappear. We don't seem to realize that we're walking on eggshells like this. He preserves all the divine works as though in act, and he lets nothing escape the divine will. And in one who lives in the divine will, it wants to make known the goods that it contains. Therefore, I want to make known to you the reason for which I wanted to receive myself when I instituted the Most Holy Eucharist. This explanation will help you enormously, if you're not doing it already, how to make your thanksgiving after communion. The prodigy was great and incomprehensible to the human mind. For a creature to be able to receive a man and God, we would say God-man, to enclose the infinite in the finite being and to give to this infinite being divine honours. Now, you have to ring the word divine, because when we give him flowers and nice altar cloth and nice candles and stuff, it's human honours. To give him divine honours, decorum, and a dwelling worthy of him, this mystery is so obtuse and so incomprehensible that the apostles themselves, while they easily believed in the incarnation and in many other mysteries, remained troubled before this particular mystery. And their intellects were reluctant to believe. And it took my repeated teaching, you have to put in the word teaching there, for them to surrender. So what to do? I, who instituted the Eucharist, was to take care of everything, since when the soul would receive me, the divinity was not to lack the honours and the divine decorum and a dwelling worthy of God. Because remember, we've had this endlessly, nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. Now, but since we're talking about the Eucharist, you might put in 1 Corinthians 10 and 11. Chapters 10 and 11, where St. Paul says that if we receive the Lord unworthily, we're eating and drinking to our own condemnation. People don't realise that. There just is not enough teaching or even basic explanation of the Eucharist given anymore, so much so that it's frightening what's going on. Therefore, my daughter, as I instituted the Most Holy Sacrament, my eternal will, united to my human will, made present to me, look at this, all the hosts which were to receive the sacramental consecration until the end of time were all present to him. Just as he said that when he was on the cross, all souls were present to him. That when he picked up the cross, he put all of us into the cross. So here at this very first consecration, he encloses all hosts in himself. He can do it because he's divine as well as human. So everything past, present and future there for him. So my eternal will, united with my human will, made present to me all the hosts that were to receive the sacramental consecration until the end of centuries. And I looked at them one by one. You'd wonder how that's possible. It's only that because he's divine. I consumed them, he said, and I saw my sacramental life palpitating in each host, yearning to give itself to creatures. In the name of the whole human family, my humanity took on the commitment for every soul and gave a dwelling within itself to each host. When you consider how lackadaisical people are today about handling the sacred host and giving it to people and receiving it, and the lack of thanksgiving afterwards, I can't cope. I just keep my eyes closed. I keep my head down and my eyes closed. I can't cope at all. Not if you understand anything you're reading here, you wouldn't. So each sacramental host, he said, was deposited in me. And it contains the dwelling of my humanity and the cortege of the honours of my divinity, because he's divine and human. Otherwise, how could I descend into the creature, since none of us are worthy? And as I say to him, none of us can be worthy. And it was only because of this. Now, you see, you need to ring the word only. It was only because of this that I tolerated the sacrilegious, the coldness, the irreverence, the ingratitude, since in receiving myself, I secured my own decorum, the honours and the dwelling which befitted my very person. Had I not received myself, he said, I could not have descended into creatures. And they would have lacked the way, the door, the means to receive me. It's just put John 15:5, without me, you can do nothing. Now, the only commentary on that that I can give you verbatim, and I've read many commentaries on the scriptures, is a commentary by St. Therese of Lisieux. She said, if he says that we can do nothing without him, he obliges himself to do it for us. That's exactly what you've just read. That he made up for every single one of us. And he made sure that the correct reverence and everything was given to the sacred host. Otherwise, he couldn't come to people as unworthy as us. And in the next paragraph, he's going to give the answer that Protestants need with regard to the Mass. They need this badly. And if you ever wondered, oh, where would I find a text that I can use? Here it is. This is my usual way in all my works, he said. I do them once in order to give them to all the other times. Now, he has explained this with regard to redemption, that he did everything through Blessed Mother. And now in the Divine Will, he's doing everything through Louisa. OK. And with regard to the Eucharist, he did everything himself. OK. So I do them once in order to give life to all the other times in which they are to be repeated, uniting them to the first act as if they were one single act. So the power, the immensity, the all-seeingness of my will made me embrace all centuries. It made present to me the communicants and all sacramental hosts. Now try and imagine, back there when he created the Eucharist, he was with me every single time I received him. And he made up for absolutely everything that is lacking in me. It's mind-boggling, isn't it? We can't conceive of a love that's this great, can we? But it certainly means that when we die and go before the great white throne, we don't have a prayer, to use our language. He's done everything for us.
So he's divinized us.
Yeah.
Through the sacrament.
Yeah, but unfortunately we have free will.
Yeah.
So while he has done everything and it's possible for me to say, yes, I want it all. Mm. And I'll go, I'll do it. I only have to put myself aside and hand over my will. That's all. It's dead easy. There's nothing complicated about it. You know, you remember Maximilian Kolbe? He was only 6 and he had been spanked by his mother, and his mother told him he was incorrigible. Mm. And he went down to the church and our Blessed Lady appeared to him and showed him a crown, a white crown of holiness and purity in the priesthood. And she said, these are only given to very special people, she said, to this incorrigible kid, you know. And he looked at it and she said, there's another one as well. She said, we don't give this very often. He said, what's the other one? Because a child is like that. You've aroused the curiosity. And that's to get them to ask. So then she showed him the red crown of martyrdom. And she said, it's only for very special people, you know. And all the, I said, I'll have the two of them. He got the two of them. You see, the Lord presents us with what he has done, but we have to say, yes, I want it. And this is the surrender that's actually required of us. And the sooner we say the surrender, the better. Yeah. Some of us drag our heels all the way and everybody knows, oh, look who was on this journey. I know the footprint, it's been there for years. And other people just go. It's just amazing. So here, he has been with each one of us in every single communion. I just find that mind-boggling, you know. It's been absolutely amazing. So my all-seeingness made me embrace all centuries. It made present to me the communicants and all sacramental hosts. And I received myself as many times so that through myself I might pass into each soul. He alone could do it. We couldn't do it. But we're so casual about communion, it's very frightening. Who has ever thought of so much love as mine, he said, that in order to descend into the hearts of creatures, I was to receive myself so as to secure the divine rights and to be able to give them not only myself, but the very act I did in receiving myself. Now, you need every single time to say, Lord, I enter into your acts in receiving yourself. And with your will, I make them my own. And then you offer them for whatever you want. But it's actually important for us to enter into his acts in receiving himself. And I did this to dispose them and almost to give them the right. Notice the almost. I underline the almost. Almost to give them the right to receive me. Louisa said she was very surprised. And as if I wanted to doubt, she said, and Jesus said, why do you doubt? Is this not perhaps to operate as God? Is this not the way God actually does things? And this one single act of forming as many acts for as many who want to enjoy it while it remains one single act, was it not the same for the act of the incarnation of my life and of my passion? I incarnated myself only once. My life was only one. My passion was only one. And yet the incarnation, life and passion is for you and for every other soul individually. As if you were the only one who ever lived. Isn't it incredible? So they are still in act. That is present, active, full of grace, full of all the merits. Everything is all there for you. And it's available for you. You can open up anytime you like and receive all the grace. That's why I describe Catholics as people who sit outside of a bank that they own, starving to death. They own the bank. They don't bother to go in and get the money to get what they need. And some of them don't even turn up on Sundays or anything. It's unbelievable. So he said, it's the same as if I was incarnating myself right at this moment and suffering my death for you at this very moment. And so it is correct to say that when we're at Mass, we're at the Last Supper. It's actually correct because it's all present to us. If it were not so, he said, I wouldn't be operating like God. I'd only be operating like a creature who, not containing a divine power, cannot let herself be possessed by all or give herself to all. Now, we can't give ourselves to all except by fusing into the divine will, and through him, with him and in him, you can reach everything. Now, my daughter, he said, I want to tell you of another excess of my love. One who does my will and lives in it. Now, living in it means 24/7, 365. Not doing an act every now and then. One who does my will and lives in it comes to embrace the works of my humanity. So that has to be John, 14:7 or something like that. They will do the same works as I do when I go to the Father. Okay. Verse 7 doesn't sound right. Might be verse 12. So one who does my will and lives in it comes to embrace the works of my humanity, because I greatly yearn that the creature become similar to me. That's Romans 8:29. He wants to transform us into him. And since my will and the soul's are one, my will takes pleasure in her, and enjoying itself, it places all the good that I contain into the soul, and I form in her the deposit of my very sacramental hosts, making us living hosts. Okay. My will, which she contains, lends her and surrounds her with divine decorum, homage and honour, and I entrust everything to her, because I am certain to keep my works in a safe place. That's because she's living in the divine will. And since my will becomes the actor, spectator and custodian of all my goods, of my works and of my very life. Now, that needs a good deal of thinking about. And I'm going to stop there because the next message is long and I don't want to just start it.